This month on AZMcast, we're going to ease you guys into May. Seniors, you're on the home stretch. That real paycheck is so close you can taste it. Don't spend it all in one place. Juniors, your days as being the workhorse for the emergency department are going to last for a couple more months, but you're almost done. Interns, we're so proud of you. Look at all you learned in the last year. You guys are doing fantastic. So this month, we're going to give you a little bit of extra knowledge. We're going to do some heme core content. We're going to do a new segment that we are going to do called A Million Ways to Die. You think that after this much of a residency, you've learned all the different ways you could, that somebody could die? We've got a couple more. We're going to talk about EMTALA. Yeah, that little thing, that piece of paper we make you sign, if you screw it up, costs you $50,000. Yeah, that one. And last, we're going to talk with Art Sanders about how do you learn from different people's practice styles. It's actually really a good talk, and hopefully you guys will enjoy it as well. So on to May, on to goodness. Hope you guys enjoy. So this month we're talking about hemonc stuff, and I was sitting around thinking about it, and I thought, you know, so we just covered this for the in-service review, and I don't really think that we should rehash some of those things, but there were two things that stood out in my mind that I think that we could cover that the emergency physician should know about, and I think it has a potential to change practice and change lives. And the two diseases, they're both hematology related, that I think we should know about are TTP and HLH.
So I'm going to stop you right there because I've only seen each of these once, and both times I had to look up what the acronym means. So
I would argue that you've probably seen both of them more than once, you just didn't know it.
I would argue that too. So what's TTP?
Thrombotic thrombus.
I knew you didn't know. Yeah. Thrombotic thrombocytopenic purpura.
Right.
So, and then HLH is?
Hemophagocytic lymphohistiocytosis.
Okay.
Just to cut in here real quick, you're probably asking yourself, why do I need to know about this stuff? I learned about it in medical school. I passed my boards. I'm done. I don't need to know this anymore. Well, you're wrong, because people have these weird diseases, and we have to at least have a cursory knowledge of them. Jared sees them more often than most because he's in the ICU, but if you actually have someone that comes in with this, it's good to have a few of these things on the tip of your tongue. So bear with us. I know this is maybe a little more in-depth than the core stuff you may have wanted, but it's pretty interesting stuff. And when you see one, you'll go, I'm really glad I paid attention.
You have a patient, and the reason I want to talk about both of these is that both of these are sepsis mimics, and both of them lead to extremely high mortality rates in the north of 90% rate if they're not treated aggressively and early. They both of them have very specific early therapies and diagnostic procedures. So it's not like you can just treat sepsis and then by de facto hit these other two diseases. So, you know, let's say you have somebody with TTP. They're going to come in febrile, hypotensive. They're going to have what looks like acute kidney injury. They're going to be altered. They're going to have what looks like liver injury, and you're not sure if it's shock liver or whatnot, or primary liver dysfunction. And this looks an awful lot like a lot of patients that we see in septic shock. So my suggestion would be is that if you have somebody who looks like they're in septic shock and you don't have a clear primary source for the infection, start thinking about something like TTP. And the reason you get TTP is that normally you have an enzyme that it's the Adams 13 enzyme that cleaves von Willebrand factor when you have endothelial injury. And so whenever you get endothelial injury, von Willebrand factor and factor 8 activate the cascade system. But if you don't have this enzyme, then it doesn't cleave it into smaller multimers, and then you end up rapidly activating a clotting cascade. You form thrombosis, and then you get microangiopathic hemolytic anemia. The way you diagnose it is you need a peripheral smear to look for schistocytes, and then it has to be treated with plasma exchange, plasmapheresis. So I would keep that in mind. If you have somebody who's in shock, multi-organ failure, you don't have a clear reason for it, just send a peripheral smear and see if there are schistocytes.
So when you have a patient like this, definitely treat for sepsis, since that's going to be the most common thing. But keep this in the back of your mind. And just to review the pentad from those of you that have already done step 3 and hope you'll never have to see this again. So you have first thrombocytopenia. You have neurologic symptoms such as altered mental status or some bizarre behavior hallucinations. You've got kidney failure, fever, and MAHA, microangiopathic hemolytic anemia. which basically is going to amount to some jaundice, some anemia, and on this peripheral smear, schistocytes like Jared's talking about.
Yeah, keep it in mind for the patients that are in shock, multi-organ failure, that doesn't make sense. You don't have a clear reason why.
So I was very proud of myself when I caught this because I walked into the room. I said, something's not right with the patient. The patient said, I feel like I did last time I had TTP. And something in my gut just made me think, something's wrong with this patient. I need to investigate this. So I got a peripheral smear. And I got a haptoglobin, which is another part of the workup to look for hemolysis. Lo and behold, they actually found some. So I called HemOnc, and the patient says, I'm starting to feel worse like I did last time when I had TTP. And I told her to be quiet because I'm thinking. I'm trying to figure out what's going on. And HemOnc agreed. We ended up treating her in the ED. We got the Red Cross to come down to do plasmapheresis in the ED. So this is actually how quickly you can do it. I've never seen the Red Cross in the ED before, but when I said I have a patient with TTP and I'm putting a VAS cath in her right now, they said, we'll be right down.
Yeah, this is one of those things that you've probably seen, you just don't realize it, because I'll tell you, we end up diagnosing it a few times a year, a couple days later in the ICU when things just aren't adding up. And then come to find out, you start looking back through it and you get a peripheral smear and they have TTP, so...
Cool. Now, HLH is the other one, and this one I took care of after someone else had been smart enough to diagnose it.
HLH is another one where if they're just in profound shock and things aren't adding up, then you have to start thinking about it. And to be honest, this is a fairly, we've known about this diagnosis for a long time, but this is something that we've really started pouring our attention into after we've diagnosed a few of these cases in the last few years. I can tell you that this year alone, I know particularly of three cases of HLH. One of them was started by a Rocky Mountain spotted fever in a 20-something-year-old patient that we had put on ECMO. It turns out he had HLH, and then it was started by a Rocky Mountain spotted fever. HLH is usually started by something. So hemophagocytic lymphohistiocytosis, exactly what it sounds like it would be where...
Exactly what it sounds like, everybody. All right.
You have a cytokine storm from some kind of insult, usually a viral infection, bacterial infection, whatever. And it turns your macrophages into like the zombie apocalypse macrophages, and they start chewing up all of your other cell lines. So you're going to have anemia, you're going to have lymphopenia, although you may have leukocytosis. And you're going to have thrombocytopenia. And the diagnostic thing of choice for us is a ferritin. And if you get a ferritin and it's above 10,000 or so, you know that's HLH in the absence of hemosiderosis.
Now, ferritin's an acute phase reactant normally, though, isn't it?
It is, but it does not go above 10,000.
Interesting. Okay.
So if you have a ferritin that's above 10,000, really there's only two things for the most part that will cause that. Somebody who's got hemosiderosis from frequent transfusions and HLH.
Okay. So again, the clinical picture is going to look like sepsis. They're going to have fever. They're going to have some lymphadenopathy, maybe some kind of a strange rash. But jaundice will once again be an issue because you've got hemolysis. So looking for signs of hemolysis in a patient with shock will lead you down different roads. If you've got a kid who's in shock, you want to treat their sepsis aggressively, but if you notice there's hemolysis, you start thinking of that weird stuff like hemolytic uremic syndrome or other issues like that. Hemolysis is a big deal with a sepsis or a shock-like picture because that's going to increase your pucker factor to say something else is going on besides just frank bacterial sepsis.
Yeah, and both of these will look like septic shock with DIC, but septic shock with DIC, you can't really do much about the DIC except treat the sepsis. But both of these other things, you can do something about. So with HLH, the way you diagnose it officially is by a bone marrow biopsy and you look for hemophagocytosis. If you see a macrophage eating a megakaryocyte or a red blood cell, you know you have it. But for the most part, if you have a ferritin that's high, then you could treat with steroids, high-dose steroids.
So if you see a macrophage eating a megakaryocyte, if you double tap it twice in the head, that doesn't fix the problem?
No.
Because that's with the actual zombie apocalypse. I heard Terry Valenzuela say on a night shift one time, he goes, if I ever see a patient sit up and bite a nurse, I'm shooting them both and running to my home.
So neither of these diseases are really common. Neither of these diseases are something that should always be in the forefront of your mind, but they should all be in the back of your mind. You should treat sepsis aggressively. If it's not getting better, or there's something about it that starts to make you think, man, something is out of line, just keep these in the back of your mind. I think that's mostly what Jared wanted to get at during this section. So just as a quick summary, so TTP and HLH are going to be sepsis mimics. You're going to want to look for your pentad for TTP. You're going to want to look for a strange rash or signs of hemolysis and jaundice with both of these diseases. Just things to keep in the back of your mind, because you may not be able to do anything about it in the ER, but you're going to want to get some of this workup started so that someone will be able to get these fixed. And truthfully, in my case, of the one case of TTP I saw, I was able to get something going in the ER, and it made a huge difference. So keep these in the back of your mind. Always think hemolysis and jaundice with sepsis might be something else. So if you have a septic patient who's also jaundiced and hemolyzing, throw on the D-dimer to see if they're in DIC. Throw on the ferritin to see if this is HLH. Throw on the haptoglobin and the peripheral smear to see if they have schistocytes. A million ways to die. Oh, that went south so fast. I promise you we actually planned to do this before the movie came out, but how could you not just incorporate that? So we wanted to do a little segment just for fun. This is not anything that I would expect everybody to see all the time, you know, like HLH and TTP. But just strange ways that people can die that is something we should try to do something about in the ER. I spent the first year of my internship praying that I wouldn't kill anybody, so I prided myself on learning every single way that a person could die and what I was going to do if that kind of happened. If someone was bleeding to death out of their eyeballs, I knew what to do for it. If somebody went into a malignant arrhythmia that looked like a 10 on the Richter scale, I knew what to do about that. And every month, I was shocked that there was a new way to die that I had not learned. And to this day, I am still shocked that there are new ways to die that I have not thought about. Or even more, new ways that I can kill someone trying to keep them from dying. So we just wanted to add a couple of these. They're a little bit just fun to talk about and interesting to think about. But every once in a while, you might run into this one. So the first one that we're going to talk about is, what do you do with a patient that comes in with splenomegaly who looks like death? So I'm going to give you the case and give me an idea of what's going on. So this is a 17-year-old female of Mediterranean descent that comes in with fever, jaundice, and a large spleen. She's febrile to 38.2, so not horribly, but still febrile. And she just looks terrible. Her head's nodding up and down as she's trying to slur her words to talk to you, and she looks sick. So what's in your mind when I throw out those strange things of Mediterranean descent, and then on palpation, on abdominal palpation, she's got a big spleen? So the couple issues that go along with the red cells is if you've got a red cell problem, your spleen is the recycling plant. Your spleen takes all that stuff in, and if you are for some reason turning over too many red cells, then your spleen's going to feel it. The two issues that you have is either hemolysis or sequestration. So you've got a couple options to think about, and they're actually treated completely differently. One, the common one of the uncommon things, is to have a splenic sequestration crisis. So sickle cell patients start to store all of their red cells in their spleen. That means that they have no red cells in their periphery, which means that they are shocky, that they're hypoxic, that they look terrible. And there's a couple ways to treat this. One of the first ways is to give them a big bolus of fluid and see if you can push all those red cells out of the spleen, and they'll kind of auto-transfuse themselves. You just jar those sticky sickle cells up so that they'll redistribute. Another option is if the spleen's not being stingy and not spitting them back up, you can transfuse them. So if you feel a big spleen, that's one thing to consider.
Now, what happened in our girl's case, which is something I had never heard of, is she actually had hereditary spherocytosis. Another one of those crazy blood disorders that you're never going to see except for on the boards or that day that you put your guard down on the ED. So she had hereditary spherocytosis, meaning that her red blood cells just lyse whenever they feel like it. If the wind blows too strong, her red cells lyse. So her spleen was huge because it was full of broken, non-reusable red blood cells. She just needs blood. And she needs, if she's not reticking enough, you check a reticulocyte count on someone like this. If she's not kicking out enough blood, then she needs blood back. And she looked pretty terrible. So we gave her some blood and admitted her. The difference between the two patients is one patient is storing usable red cells that just need to be kicked back out. And the other one is storing broken red cells that have all been hemolyzed.
So what can you guys take away from this case, or really the last four diseases we talked about? Hemolysis is bad. If you see hemolysis, you need to know what the next steps are. Hemolysis and looks like sepsis, start thinking of some of these sepsis mimics. If you see somebody hemolyzing that is of Mediterranean descent, ask them, do you have sickle cell? Do you have thalassemia? Or do you have spherocytosis? If they happen to know that, your job has been made slightly easier. And then determine if their red cells are usable like they are in sickle cell or unusable like they are in spherocytosis. Hopefully, you never see one. Sometimes when I go home from a shift, I always wonder how I'm going to sleep because of all that stuff that I did, and I supervise those people, and I hope all my patients are okay. Let's talk to some people that sweat about whether or not I did that, and every other doctor in the hospital did that day. How our risk management people sleep at night, I don't know, but I'm so grateful for what they do. We're going to talk with a couple of our risk management specialists about EMTALA. EMTALA is kind of a scary beast. It's something that we don't really think about. We think, well, I'm going to do what's good for the patient, but there are some very specific things that, according to federal law, have to be done, or else not only are we subject to a huge fine, but the whole hospital can be put under notice if we have an EMTALA violation. CMS comes in and gets pretty angry about it. So if you're going to the middle of nowhere, if you're going to a big tertiary center, you need to understand EMTALA, you need to understand what's required, what's not required, and what your responsibility is as either the sending or the accepting physician. So this month we're going to be talking about an issue that every first year attending should really have down, and really anybody that works in emergency medicine should have down pretty well. We're going to talk about EMTALA. So this is the emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act. I got it right this time. And this is something that was established back in 1986 to try to curb some of the very unethical practices that have been happening with patient dumping when they were unable to pay, when they didn't have insurance. So EMTALA came about that all patients seeking emergency care needed to have a medical screening exam performed by a medical provider. And EMTALA has taken lots of different forms from here, and the interpretation has started to expand. So I was going to ask some of our risk management people to comment on a few things that are particularly important to us in the emergency department, especially for those of you that are going to be going out to community where you're going to be sending a lot of people, or for those of you that are going to be in a tertiary center where you're going to be receiving a lot of people. And I think those are the two groups that we're going to be talking to. So if our risk management people wouldn't mind introducing themselves.
I'm Linda Smith. I'm the Director of Litigation and Risk Management. And I'm Karen Fowler. I'm the risk manager for the hospitals.
Great. Thank you both for joining us this month. So to start, you kind of have two parties that play with any kind of contract. That's what a lawyer once told me. So in this case, the contract that we're making, so to speak, with EMTALA is that I am sending you this patient for X reason, and you are willing to accept this patient because you are able to satisfy that reason. To kind of expound on that, we can talk first about the sending doctor. What must I lack at my hospital in order to transfer a patient under EMTALA once they've had their medical screening exam?
Well, the key word is capacity here. If your organization does not have the capacity to care safely for a patient, you can certainly transfer that patient to a higher level of care. That's a simple answer.
And I think capacity for what we fill out on our forms usually is, do we have the specialty care available? Do we have the bed space to actually be able to house this patient? And something else that kind of comes into play is the patient's wishes or the patient's physician. A couple times we've transferred out from the university hospital because it was the patient's wishes or their doctor was at another hospital. So they were able to do that. So before I transfer someone, it would be easy for me to say, this person is sick, I'm terrified of this patient, I just want them out of my ER as fast as possible. I see that a lot with kids, because kids are scary to ER docs. And I think one of the things that I wanted to ask you to comment on a bit was, how do you document the stability of a patient before they leave the emergency department?
Well, if the patient's not stable, I mean, you also have to document that. So if the patient is stable, that's important. You simply just say, patient stable, and it's always nice to use evidence by, you know, vital signs stable, respiratory status stable, so forth. And I don't know if you're going to ask the same question about transferring the patient, the private vehicle, the patient. I understand from Dr. Leach that he gets asked a lot, can we transfer in the private vehicle of the parents? And if you're here, we're going to tell you no, that's not a good idea. But sometimes he gets the call from the transferring hospital wanting to bring the patient here and wanted to know where the liability lied with that. And essentially, that's where the patient could very well be unstable. And the best advice is to give them is obviously bring them by ambulance or other transport, but not the private vehicle. And the liability lies with the sending physician, the sending hospital. That's where the liability lies, and not with the accepting physician. But it's always nice to give them the recommendation on that they should probably use an ambulance, for example.
This will probably be a little bit terrifying to you, but I heard one time a physician was transferring a patient, and they said the patient's hypoxic and on oxygen. I said, well, I think they should come by ambulance. And they said, oh, don't worry, I already sent him with an oxygen tank. And I think my response was something like, well, I hope it doesn't run out in the drive-thru at McDonald's on the way over here. But these are some of the things that you have to consider when you're sending, because legitimately some of the physicians say, well, I'm transferring this patient, but the parents are going to get this ambulance bill, and I don't want them to have to deal with it. There is a consideration on that end. But on our consideration, we're in the ER. We always think worst-case scenario, and I think that having them transported by a medical provider is usually a good idea. If I'm a transferring hospital and I'm sending a patient because I'm having a difficult time stabilizing them, is there any benefit to sending them with a physician like myself or with a nurse to say, well, we're going to send a nurse with the paramedics just in case something happens?
Absolutely. And again, capacity is the reason you're transferring them. If you can't stabilize them here, then do send them with somebody who has the experience and professional training that can care for that patient during the transfer. It's a good idea. And they are covered by their insurance to do that. Just that question comes up a lot too.
One of the issues that I ran into once this year was we are on code purple, code triage, whatever it's going to be called at your hospital. And what I was told is, well, we can't accept any more patients. And we got a call. Thankfully, it was from an urgent care who they don't have to fall under these same EMTALA guidelines. But they wanted to transfer a patient. I said, you know, we're very full right now. We're on code purple. I would recommend that you send them to another facility for faster care. But if you send them here, of course, we'll try to take care of them as fast as possible. They had never heard of that. We'd never said anything like that before. Can you comment a little bit on kind of the code purple? We're going to be talking with our EMS people a little bit later on what that means. But what does it mean when our hospital goes on code purple, and what does that mean from a EMTALA standpoint as far as being able to accept as a tertiary center?
I just want to clarify that code purple essentially means that we are not on diversion. It simply means that we're trying to move inpatients to discharge, for example, if possible, to move ED patients in. We actually do have a policy, and it simply says the purpose of Code Purple is to assure patient progression and, most importantly, to protect the safety of our patients. The goal is to help facilitate patient flow and expedite discharges. So that I just wanted to make clear. So when we are asked to accept a patient, you can simply make the recommendation, but always be very clear that you're not refusing to accept a patient. Even if we don't have capacity and they say we're sending that patient, we obviously have to accept the patient. Once they hit our property, we must follow the EMTALA rules and do the stabilization, the medical exam and the stabilization. So we always accept patients. If it's the only time I understand, and I learned this just this past week, is the only time we technically divert patients is if our infrastructure would be damaged. So that's kind of like never. We hope.
We'd have to have some kind of an internal disaster, or our computers would all have to explode. Surprised that didn't happen in November, but actually Epic rolled out pretty well. So
yeah, it did. And again, I think it's important here, and I probably should have said this first, that capacity is very, very important. And I will give you an example. We had a physician who, an attending physician, who absolutely was extremely exhausted, and our ICU beds were just about full, but she physically could not take the patient. And this rarely ever happens. We were reported to CMS, and it was documented that she physically did not have the capacity to take that patient emotionally, mentally, and they did not fine us and believe that that met the requirement for not being able to take the patients because of the capacity. We tell them we don't have capacity, and I say that's the key, but if a patient does come on our property, we have to resume the examination and stabilization.
I think it's important to differentiate the capacity that we provide as a hospital from your own mental capacity as a resident or attending. Your capacity may be in question, but we should always be accepting people when we can as a tertiary center. So switching over from the sender to the receiver, since we've already been talking about that, so what do I have in order to accept a patient? We talked about capacity. Do I have the specialty care available? Do I have the bed space available? Do I have that patient's doctor who wants them to be transferred in through the ER? With this comes in a couple interesting things that I ran into this year. There was a very sick patient in an outside hospital that needed a subspecialty surgeon, and they called me to say, we can't get a hold of this surgeon. We want to transfer him to your hospital because I know you have the capability there, but we can't get a hold of the on-call surgeon for one reason or another. Now, in my mind, I don't know, is he in surgery right now and can't break away? Is he in a car accident somewhere? Is he asleep because his pager batteries died? I didn't really know how to get a hold of him. So my question was, aren't I going to be in the same place if we accept that patient? If we technically have the services, but we can't get a hold of the provider themselves, what would you recommend in a situation like that?
Well, I've personally talked to a couple of ED physicians, and they have said that the emergency room doctors do try not to accept for the surgeons because, as you know, we don't know where they are. We don't know what they do. They might be in the OR. But in general, we do accept if we have somebody listed on call and we understand they're supposed to be backups. So do what you can, your due diligence to try to reach the surgeon, but in general, we do have to accept them.
And that's what we ended up doing. We put it up the chain of command a couple times and finally got a hold of someone and we were able to accept them. I said, package them up and get everything ready to go. And as soon as we find out, go ahead and put them in the ambulance. And we got a hold of a surgeon that accepted, and thankfully the patient did very well. So, but it was kind of a tense moment for me saying, what am I going to do? Am I going to have to transfer the patient out? If I can't get a hold of the surgeon, what are we going to have to do? Thankfully, it all worked out. But that's why our hospital operators and physicians resources has that chain of command of, can't get a hold of this person, we're calling this one. Can't get a hold of that one, we're calling that one. Thankfully, that works out.
One of the things that we've seen as an issue in potential transfers from other facilities is when the surgeon or somebody thinks that the sending hospital should have someone on call, believes that there should be a call list and somebody should be there, and that they should not be transferring this patient. Unfortunately, under EMTALA, it doesn't matter what we think should be happening. We are required to accept a patient from a sending facility, regardless of what we think of that facility's ability to care for that patient. We can then later go back through appropriate channels to deal with that issue. But at the point in time where the hospital or the provider calls and says, I need to transfer this patient, it's not our place to argue with them about whether they should or should not have someone on call. We accept the patient and go from there. And it's been a huge, huge issue. I know that sometimes physicians feel like they're being abused because they're on call and another facility doesn't have somebody on call. But the unfortunate reality is that we are required by the law to accept them if we have the capacity. So we need to just go ahead and take them and then make sure that you report that. You can do a safety intelligence report. You can call Dr. Theodoro. You can go up through your ED chain and let somebody know that there's a problem, and then we'll follow up from there.
And there's somebody in every group that you go to that is going to be in charge of this. If you don't know who that is, probably the medical director for your group will. So if you have an issue like this, it's good to have a little bit of evidence behind it when it actually comes to this, to say, here was the situation, we're having this problem a lot. Otherwise, it's a lot of hearsay. Mm-hmm. So very good to document it.
Documentation is a key for us when we investigate. And not only that, when CMS comes to investigate, because they're going to say, well, it's not documented, so we don't quite understand it, and we're not going to do anything about it. And that's very frustrating to our physicians who want some action taken.
Absolutely. Another issue that we've seen from sending facilities is that the person on our end may feel like that sending facility doesn't really need to send the patient. And unfortunately, the truth is, EMTALA requires that if the sending facility believes it needs to send the patient, it needs to send the patient. And so even if we think that that patient could be managed at that outside facility, we can certainly offer suggestions for how they could manage the patient. But we also have to make it very clear that we are not refusing to accept that transfer and that we are accepting that patient.
I had something like that at another hospital I worked at, where a kid had his G-tube fall out and the parents were from out of town, and they said, we put a Foley catheter in, which is what you're supposed to do, and good. All right, well, does it work? Yeah, we can flush it and everything works fine. Okay, so why are you transferring? Well, he doesn't have a G-tube. Well, he doesn't need one. He has the Foley catheter. And what the doctor finally said is, I am uncomfortable with this patient. And when you hear that, you should immediately say, good, go ahead and send him. We'll try to work on everything else, because you don't want someone to be uncomfortable with a patient. That's when they're going to make mistakes. So if you feel comfortable with it, then you can lay hands and eyes on the patient and decide everything's okay. If you've got a doctor or a licensed independent practitioner that wants to transfer you a patient because they feel uncomfortable, those are the patients you want.
Absolutely, absolutely.
This kind of goes into a little bit of the third thing I wanted to ask you about, appropriateness, of who decides the appropriateness of a transfer. And I think you said that just then, of, you know, so they're uncomfortable with it. The sending physician decides this is a patient that needs to be transferred. And in cases of, this is an OB patient that's
not quite an active labor, maybe she's in active labor, or this was a patient that, yeah, I feel is stable, and they arrive and we feel they were unstable. How do you decide when that transfer of responsibility happens from the sending physician to the receiving physician?
Well, it's very clear that the responsibility for the patient remains with the sending facility until that patient arrives and is accepted physically by the receiving facility. So you're not responsible for the decisions that are made outside of our facility, and you're also not responsible for what happens during transfer. We're just responsible to accept the transfer once the patient arrives.
Likewise, if you're the sending physician, you are responsible from the moment that you see that patient until the moment they arrive at the receiving facility. Keep that in mind when you're getting everything transferred.
And that should play into your decision about how you transfer the patient and who the appropriate people are to send with the patient. So if you're looking at, for example, a pregnant patient, maybe you want to send an OB nurse who might be able to do that delivery or do that infant resuscitation in case that baby delivers in transfer.
And we often get to be the Monday morning quarterback and say, I can't believe they sent that patient by helicopter. What a waste. That was too much. Or, I can't believe they sent that patient by personal vehicle. Not enough. Mm-hmm. We get the benefit of doing that at our nice tertiary center. But as the sending physician, you get to decide what is appropriate. Do you have any other thoughts for people that are going to go out into practice on their own that they should keep in mind, bear in mind, with regards to EMTALA?
I think there are a couple of things. Linda already mentioned when we look at patients that we're considering for transfer and documenting that they're stable for transfer, I think it's important that you understand that that means you believe that there's not going to be a material deterioration in the patient's condition during the transfer. That's what it means that the patient is stable for transfer. So the patient doesn't have to be perfect. You just have to believe that that patient is okay and is not going to deteriorate during that transfer. One of the other things that we've seen happen is sometimes patients arrive at the facility by accident, especially with the name changes and the integration that we've gone through. People don't understand that there are two University of Arizona medical centers. And so we've had patients show up at South Campus who were supposed to be at University Campus, or patients show up at University Campus who were supposed to be at South Campus. The important thing for you to remember is that once they're on your property, you are responsible to do and document the appropriate medical screening exam and give the stabilizing treatment that's necessary. You can't say, oh, you're not supposed to be here, go there. Because unfortunately, once they arrive, we are responsible to make sure that we meet the requirements of EMTALA. And I've seen lots of issues, not only within our facilities, but at other facilities across this town where the ambulance drives into the bay and somebody says, you're not supposed to be here. Once they're here, we've got them.
That's a really, really important point. I wouldn't have thought of that if you wouldn't have brought that up. So, in a quick question about saying that they won't deteriorate in transport, I know that that's one of the risks we always make them sign off on with the EMTALA form. I think the best example would be neonates. When we have a premature delivery at South Campus, it needs to be transferred. I know just working in the neonatal ICU, I get nervous walking them down the hallway. If we tip them one way too far, they're going to code. So how would you phrase that to say, we have stabilized them to the best of our ability, we've done as much as we can, but there's still a risk? How would you phrase that?
I think that you can say that we've stabilized them within our capacity. And that's, once again, that important term to make sure that we've done everything that we can. And because we can't provide any more, we need to move them to someplace that has those other things that this baby needs. And that gives you that cushion.
So everybody that's at South, that's a good phrase to keep in mind when you're transferring patients, because you're going to be transferring a lot more than we will up at University. But I'll be right there with you in my couple shifts a month I get to work at South. So.
There's just one more thing that I think it's only fair that you're aware. If you're working here and at many other organizations, these calls are recorded through the patient resource services. So sometimes you may get upset and say things that you shouldn't say. And I'm just saying this in the best way I can say it. These things can be used against you if you say things that probably shouldn't be said. Name calling, for example, and those kinds of things actually do occur. And because these are recorded for quality purposes, we do try to protect them. But in the end, if CMS comes and says, I want to hear the recording, I will tell you 99% of the time, it really tells us what's happened and gives us a feel for exactly what each party was thinking. So I think it's very important that you're aware that you are recorded and that during those recordings, you always say, we always accept. Well, no matter what, you'll accept that patient. I think it's very important that you're very careful.
It's a nice way to diffuse. It's a nice way to diffuse an angry person on the other line, yes, as well, to say, are you aware this is a recorded line? With that 5 seconds of silence and then a very abrupt attitude change. So
that's exactly right.
That's a great point. Well, thank you both very much. I really appreciate your time. It's very nice to be able to pick your brain about some of these questions and hopefully give you less headaches in the future because of it. So
we like it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May is a very interesting time of year. It's the time of year where interns are really starting to get their feet under them and starting to feel like they know what they're doing. Juniors are starting to get into their seniorness and developing their own plans, developing their own clinical judgment. And seniors, some of you have your own licenses and have been making your own decisions for the past couple months. So it can be a little difficult in May and June to still be in the ER, to still work with an attending, and to have a disagreement about how you would manage a patient. This happens pretty frequently, and most of the academic attendings are pretty used to it. We like that you guys are coming into your own. We like that you're coming up with plans that maybe we hadn't thought of and we can pretend are our own. But there's definitely a little bit of an art to working with attendings that can be more or less conservative with the patient. So I talked with Art Sanders about this a few months ago, and thankfully he was willing to come back on the program and discuss it with me again. I think it's really good to listen to so that you can try to decide, how am I going to make this the best learning experience that I can? Any conflict, any patient, anything that you come up with during your residency, how can I turn this into something that's going to be better? So hopefully you guys enjoy. So I'm sitting here with Art Sanders, and the last time that Art and I had talked, he brought up a very interesting notion. We had talked about chest pain, and we interviewed several attendings about the same chest pain patient, and we got several different, almost completely different answers about how to manage them. And what he had told me was, this would be interesting to discuss, is how do you learn from different management styles? I think that that's very relevant as a resident. As an intern, especially somewhere in July, you're kind of looking for your attending's approval a little bit. But as you continue to progress and you learn more, especially from different attendings, it can be a little bit difficult, it can be a little bit frustrating, or even a little bit bewildering to say what's the right answer for management. So I thought this was a great thing that we could discuss. So, or just to kind of start to talk about this, at what point in your training do you start to see the residents develop their own practice styles instead of kind of looking for that, did I get the right answer when they present?
Well, probably second year, the residents develop their own style, but usually they're kind of quiet about bringing it out. I think it depends on the interaction and how comfortable they feel with the attending in terms of challenging, we shouldn't get this test, or we should get this test, or etc. Ultimately, the attending is responsible. The attending is the one that gets called before the quality review committee or various or legal committees or whatever, to why did they do this or do that or not do this or not do that. So ultimately it has to be the attending's decision. I think most attendings will ask the resident, what do you want to do now? And does it feel comfortable? Are they comfortable with that decision? And they'll go along with it. So even though it might not feel like that, there's a comfort zone and a give and take back and forth. I think the whole issue, as I think about it, is an issue of clinical medicine, and clinical medicine is not an exact science. It's a heuristic discipline in which each patient is treated differently. And this is probably why I used to have a professor who said one day all of medical decisions will be replaced by computers, and we'll have algorithms. And so you got chest pain, abdominal pain in a 60-year-old and a 4-year-old, whatever, and you go through this algorithm, the test will spur it out, and it'll all be a decision behind it. And that's not really what you want, and that's not really what I want as a physician or a patient. It's not what I'd want with a family. And so even though it seems like there should be algorithmic approaches, I think there are general approaches, and then you have to modify it to the patient and to how you feel comfortable and how the other physicians you work with feel comfortable. Sometimes when I've met with students, I would tell them once they get in their third year, it's very different. As many of you know, I sort of mentor students during the first 2 years, and so I'm their clinical expertise. But I may or may not mention it to them, this is a horrible way of learning. This is a modeling behavior, and people do that all the time. They sort of say, "Oh, I really admire Dr. Jones, and I'm on medicine rotation, and I work with Dr. Jones, and she's an excellent physician, and everything she does is the way I'll adapt when I approach hypertension or hypercalcemia or hyponatremia or any sort of clinical problem." And they don't realize that that's a modeling behavior, which is a very poor level of learning. And it may be good that Dr. Jones, and you try to emulate the personality of Dr. Jones, but that's one style and it's one practice style. And so having different attendings, different residents, getting a broad approach to a clinical problem is actually a gift. And you may not realize it at this time, but when you look back, you may say, oh yeah, you know, there's this way to approach it, this way to approach it. And my general advice is there's critical actions, just like in the emergency medicine boards and the oral boards, there's critical actions. And I think everyone would agree that certain things should be done on every patient with this circumstance. A 60-year-old female comes in with a feeling of discomfort in their chest, not getting an EKG would be inappropriate. Or somebody who hasn't had a tetanus shot in 15 years and comes in with a dirty wound to their face or something should have a tetanus shot. I don't think there's an argument in that. So in every case, there are probably only 2, 3, 4 critical actions if you look back at it. And the rest of it is this gray area of medicine where maybe you could do it, maybe you can't. What does the patient want? What do you want to do? What does the attending want to do? What is the standard in that community? And that's an area to explore. Explore what is the literature? What is what do people want to do? What is the risk of missing something? You know, one of the things I think about is I don't want to miss appendicitis. I don't want to miss a AAA. But if I miss a kidney stone, well, you know, I might get criticized, you missed a kidney stone. But the vast majority, we don't do anything immediate. I can't think of the last kidney stone we did anything immediate about. You treat their pain. You have arranged for some follow-up. So again, you sort of say, well, what do you reasonably want to accomplish with this patient, and how can you work with them on that?
I'm still very new in my attendingship, and it doesn't faze me once if a resident says, you know, the latest article shows this, or we just had a patient where we saw this, therefore I'd like to do that. That doesn't bother me one bit because I'm still learning quite a bit every day. You've been an attending for a while. Do you ever feel threatened when a resident says, I don't like that plan, I think we should do this instead? Or how do you feel attendings respond to this in general?
Obviously there are times of stress, and maybe people have had individual reactions and think about stress or other sorts of things that may be happening. But I think the vast majority of times the attending would welcome that. That would be, one, the attendings are still learning, and that's one of the beauty of being a faculty member and having residents around and attending journal club and conferences, is you're always hopefully learning. And medicine is a changing discipline. Again, I think I would admire a resident who brings up a paper or brings up, well, I did this and this. And then, again, that's an opportunity to learn. I think there is a factor of personality and experience for good or bad. So, for example, I was chief of staff for a few years. I was before that head of it's called Quality Review Committee. And you saw all the bad cases. There are members of our faculty on the Legal Review Committee, which gets all the bad cases. And that lends to your experience. Even if it didn't happen to you, you see this and this happen and this and this happen. And you'll build your own experience. And that may play into it. And then there's also personality. And in some ways, having this experience of varying attendings and why are they ordering this test or not ordering this or sending this patient out, etc., might give you a sense of where your personality fits in. So working as an emergency physician in cells is very different than working in a trauma center. So you see somebody with a lack on their head and they're maybe drunk, and but you think that's all it is? Do you feel comfortable watching them, or do you want to ship them out right away for a CT scan? Well, you know, it depends how much of a tolerance for following them along. Now, I would say either of those are acceptable as long as you do serial neuro exams and follow the patient. If they deteriorate, ship them out. But if you don't feel comfortable in that situation, you need to work in a trauma center where you can get the appropriate tests, etc.
I remember as a resident working with two attendings on the same shift, one of them highly risk adverse. Every test needed to be ordered, and we needed to make sure we never missed anything. The other was highly risk sensitive. I'm sure nothing is wrong with this patient. Just go ahead and send them home. We don't need to do anything. And I got diagnostic whiplash going back and forth between the attendings. How do you suggest that residents deal with an attending, or maybe deal with is the wrong word, how do you suggest residents approach an attending who they feel is being either too conservative or too liberal?
Well, I think you need to approach the situation. First of all, I think you can't take it personally. You take it as a learning experience, and then find what are the critical actions with this patient. Now, obviously, if the one attending who's tolerates a lot of risk, you feel is passing a critical action, you need to bring that up for patient safety. But if they're both within the three or four critical actions on the patient, then it's an issue of learning from it. What is the number needed to treat to get this diagnostic test? What is the risk? The more diagnostic tests you do, the more things you find that you don't need to find, and the more trouble you get into. It's not just radiation, but maybe you don't particularly want to find the PSA is elevated. That's what they're finding in prostate cancer, because it leads this whole, it probably leads to more trouble than it risks. It's not even an economic issue. It's an issue that patient safety is probably harmed. And in fact, the person who developed the researcher who developed the PSA is actually on the faculty here at the University of Arizona, and says this is the, he wrote a book saying this is the worst thing he ever invented. It's harmed a lot more people than it's helped.
You don't want to find an incidental OMA and then say, well, now what do I do about this?
Right. Right. So you do another test, and you, this leads to this. This leads to a biopsy. This leads to anxiety. This leads to infection or whatever, or sepsis or other sorts of things that the patient never would have been, would be more harm than benefit. So what's the number needed to harm? What's the number needed to treat? Is there some literature that can back you up one way or the other? And so the best way to look at it is a learning experience. Is your own personality one way or the other, somewhere on the spectrum, where do you fit? But maybe that's wrong. Maybe your personality shouldn't be one way or the other. And so you have to ask the literature to bail you out. And then don't take it personally, that if, you know, you can talk to up, you could bring the literature to bear and negotiate it one way or the other. The other thing is involving the patient one way or the other. And I can't quote the study, but I remember a study being presented at one of the SA meetings a while ago about admission for rule out MIs, you know, for stress tests. And if you presented the data of what's the data that they would actually be harmed by going home versus coming in and spending 2 days till they finally got their stress test and whatever, even knowing that even if they finally got cathed and a stent, there's really not good evidence that it extends their life, that most patients would say, well, I'll take the chance. It's, you know, 1 in 50 and I, you know, wouldn't have to go through this, etc. So involving the patient in it, you know, should we get this extra CAT scan? Should we get this thing? There is a chance we'll find this and that, or what's the alternative? And involving that, documenting it in the data, and I think most attendings would go along with that if they'll see their doctor and then they'll reconsider getting this other test.
I think what I kind of came down to is a lot of what you were saying is when I'm working with a very conservative attending, I would just say, well, today I'm going to pretend that every patient is going to die. So let's practice that way and let's see how that goes. And then when I'm working with a attending that may be more cavalier, or a little more liberal with his or her management, I'd say, okay, well, today I'm going to practice as if my history and physical is pinpoint accurate and I never miss a thing. We'll see how that goes. And from there, that kind of helped me develop my risk tolerance. And certainly the more I went on, it became in some cases more and in some cases less risk tolerant. So how do you see residents deal with risk as they go through their training? Do you see a progression of very risk tolerant to very risk averse, or does it vary resident to resident?
I think it varies somewhat by personality, but I think appropriately residents start out as they don't want to miss anything. They don't want to come before CPI. I think back a long time ago when I was a resident, embarrassing to get up and explain why you do it. Now, just because a bad thing happened doesn't mean you did anything wrong, even a malpractice suit. There was actually, in the famous errors in medicine study, they were actually looking for correlation of malpractice to errors in medicine, and they found there was a very poor correlation, but they found a huge incidence of medical errors that we were making, and most of them don't result in malpractice. And just a word of caution, in my experience over 35 years practice, I see very little correlation with conservative management and no malpractice suits. I think you get sued, you know, there's a whole lot of circumstances, and you do the best care, you get adverse outcomes, and you can still get sued. So you can't say I'll be conservative and I'll never be sued. It just doesn't work that way. So I think people start off more conservative, and then as they gain experience and confidence and more knowledge of the literature, what's out there, important for them. They probably become less risk averse and more able to use clinical judgment.
I've kind of seen a bell curve like that, and Jared Mosier and I have talked about this, about how the interns start out, they don't want to miss anything, can't miss anything, and then as you become a junior, you see every chest pain gets admitted, nothing ever happens to them, but you haven't seen enough of the sick ones to know that they're out there, and by the end of your junior year, beginning of your senior year, you've seen some of the bad outcomes, you've seen some of the missed cases, and then you go back to being risk averse again. So, do you have anything else you wanted to add?
I guess my advice is just, you know, develop your confidence, be open to learning, and say, okay, how am I going to learn from this situation? How am I going to learn from every attending I work with, every resident, every specialist I work with?
Well, thanks to Art for helping out with that. Really, thanks to everybody who helped out this month. I thought we had some cool stuff. We always try to get a little bit of clinical, a little bit of the documentation legal stuff, and a little bit of the practice art, which really makes our job so much fun. So if you enjoyed it, great. If you didn't enjoy it, why did you sit and listen to it for an hour? You could have done so many better things. If you only kind of enjoyed it and you have some ideas of how you could really enjoy it, send Jared or I an email. If you have ideas for the program, if you have stuff you want to hear us talk about, if you want to come on and have us talk with you about something, please let us know. We're very eager to hear your opinions and some suggestions that you might have. We've got hopefully some cool stuff coming in July, but you know, everything's always in experiments on this show. Until June, happy May. Everyone enjoy your May. Go outside before the concrete starts to cause third-degree burns, and we'll see you in June.